This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. New home construction across the country has slowed to its lowest pace since the 1980s. Bloomington Normal home builders say they're just a cog in the economic wheel.
I'm a small business. I'm building homes that based on need, and jobs create those needs. If there's no jobs, there's no need.
Home builder Tom Armstrong talks with GLT's Ryan Dunham about why it's hard but not impossible to build new homes that people can afford. It's been a decade since public smoking bans took effect in Bloomington Normal. How's that working out? Eric Stock reports. Mary Cullen reports on resources to help those who've been affected by domestic violence. And home-cooked pesticides and herbicides. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. 10 years after the Great Recession, a new housing crisis has developed in America. You've been hearing reports all week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered about those who've been shut out of the housing market. One reason is the historic slowdown in new home construction. That slowdown has played out in Bloomington Normal as well. GLT's Ryan Dunham has this report.
Tom Armstrong says the last decade has been eye-opening for his family's third-generation home-building company, Armstrong Builders. First, there was the Great Recession. And then the endless churn of state farmers willing to buy new homes slowed to a crawl. Now, opportunistic buyers are looking to cut a deal, and if they can't, they'll just go down the street and buy a really nice existing home. Armstrong is not doom and gloom about the Bloomington Normal real estate economy, but he says it's changed in big ways. If you're asking Armstrong why home builders aren't building much anymore, he says you're asking the wrong guy.
It's not me. I am merely a cog in the wheel that turns. I'm a small business. I'm building homes that based on need, and jobs create those needs. If there's no jobs, there's no need.
A dozen years ago, home builders were selling 500 new homes a year in Bloomington Normal, with new subdivisions coming onto the market routinely. But 2017, it was just 138. It'll likely be even less this year. And it's not just a Bloomington Normal issue. NPR reported this week that new home construction across the country has slowed to its lowest pace since the 1980s. In Illinois, home builders are only doing 10,000 or 11,000 projects a year now. It's down from 50,000 to 60,000 at their peak. Bloomington Normal may not need 500 new homes every year anymore, but it's still perceived as unnaturally low. Here's John Armstrong, president of the local Realtors Association.
When you got a bunch of realtors in a room, that's the elephant in the room. New construction has really been hit hard.
He says one reason is because of those higher-priced existing homes becoming more affordable.
But that 2,400-square-foot house that you can build for $330, when you can buy it for $290 existing, you know, there's a level where it's acceptable. There's a percentage where it's acceptable. I personally think it's about 6 or 7%. If you can save 6 or 7% and buy existing, why wouldn't you do that? But there are certain people out there that they just don't want anything but new. They don't want to live in somebody else's house. So those people are willing to pay 6 or 7% more. They're not willing to pay 15% more.
Tom Armstrong, the home builder, says consumer confidence in Bloomington Normal is low.
So nobody wants to get stuck with a big number when they're, you know, going to wrap up and retire. So everybody wants to negotiate $30,000 to $50,000 off of the price, which I can't do in new construction because costs are fixed. I'm buying a 2x4 for $2.50 just like everybody else.
He says people don't think of homes the same way they used to.
Nobody anymore is using their house as a vehicle to make money. They're using it as a place to live. And they're hoping that they can get their money back out of it when they move or retire.
So how are home builders responding? In a lot of cases, they're going out of business or going out of state. Membership in the Home Builders Association of Illinois has fallen from a pre-recession peak of around 5,000 to around 1,600 or 1,700 today. That's according to the association's executive vice president, Bill Warren. He says data from the National Association of Home Builders shows Illinois is dead last in the U.S. in new home construction, based on construction starts per capita. He says a lack of confidence in the state's economy is turning off potential buyers. He says that's the new reality.
So I think our guys need to start accepting that and trying to figure out in their marketing strategy how they go about building in the future.
Tom Armstrong from Armstrong Builders is one of the survivors, and he says it's no accident. They've retooled their business plan to build what they can sell. They're not just working in their own subdivisions anymore. Instead, they're building in more rural communities like Goodfield, Delavan, and Farmington, where lots are cheaper. Armstrong says he's only doing pre-sold projects now, no more speculative or spec homes with no buyer lined up in advance.
We're all scrapping to try to make money right here, and we'll do anything we can. The rehab business, snow removal, mowing yards, whatever it takes to make it ends meet during this time.
The average price for a new home in Bloomington Normal's market last year was $301,000. That average fell to $283,000 during the first few months of this year.
Everything's dropped. So nobody wants the big mini mansions anymore. They want to be efficient. They want everything to be, you know, nice things, really nice upper end appliances and nice things in their home, but smaller.
Agents say low inventory is holding back the local real estate market, especially in those more moderate price ranges for existing homes. The average price of a home sold in Bloomington Normal last year was about $175,000. 95% of that was existing or resale homes. So if the market needs more cheaper homes, why don't the home builders who need work just build them? Armstrong says the cost of land, labor, and materials makes it extremely difficult.
You cannot build at the 200 price point. And if I could, which I actually take that back, I could build at that price point, but nobody would want it. It's very difficult to even get to the 250.
McLean County's extremely fertile soil makes land difficult to acquire cheaply because it has pretty good farm use, according to John Armstrong from the Realtors Association. He says some developers are working in places like Lexington, where land is cheaper, maybe $18,000 to $20,000 a lot, than in Bloomington Normal, where it's about $60,000 a lot.
A good trigger is about 20% of the cost of your project should be in your land acquisition. So using that, if you have a $60,000 lot, you should build somewhere around a $300,000 house so that you're not over-improved for the lot.
There is one home builder who's managed to stay busy, even expand, while building homes that most working-class families can afford. It's Habitat for Humanity of McLean County, which is building six new homes this year in Bloomington Normal, with ambitions to jump to 10 with help from additional revenue from their new ReStore remodel this year. Habitat's goal is to build a home that'll yield a mortgage of around $500 to $530 a month, including taxes and insurance. Here's Executive Director Jim Walters.
We see a lot of people who are living in rental properties that aren't very safe. That's properties that aren't very well maintained. Perhaps they've got bad HVAC. Perhaps they have infestation. Perhaps the foundation's falling in. Often is the case, we'll have a family living in multiple families living in a dwelling that was intended for one family. And so it's an overcrowding type of situations. Parents sharing rooms with kids, leaky roofs, I mean, everything you can imagine. So that's our demonstrated need part of that. You know, and many of our homeowners, it's their first time that they've had a chance to own a home, or that their life has become so challenging in adulthood that they thought that was going to be out of reach for them. And then they've done a lot. They've overcome these challenges to get back to the point that they're ready for home ownership, and Habitat's the perfect program to kind of give them that handout.
I interviewed Walters outside a three-bedroom, two-story Habitat home under construction on Mulberry Street, just west of downtown Bloomington. The same style of home was built across the street in 2017, and it's appraised for $117,000. A nearly identical home they built on Church Street in Normal, appraised for $145,000.
So our house is appraised very well. We are recognized as one of the better home builders in town, besides from also being a nonprofit.
Not exactly a shocker, but Habitat's homes are so cheap in part because they're built by volunteers. Another advantage is they get the land for free. Walter says all 29 of Habitat's properties in its inventory were donated by the City of Bloomington, Town of Normal, or private individuals. So could a similar model work to reinvigorate for-profit home builders? Could we kill two birds, affordable housing and a struggling employment sector, with one stone? Bill Ward from the Home Builders Association of Illinois thinks so. He says they're trying to work with the Illinois Housing Development Authority to sketch out a program to build new homes for working families and seniors. He envisions aging, dilapidated homes being torn down and replaced by new construction. He says incentives such as tax increment financing or TIF districts or other mechanisms could be used to provide a profit margin for the builders or give the lots to the homeowners.
You could generate new housing in our small and medium-sized communities that really need it because our housing stock is decaying.
Whatever happens, local builders like Tom Armstrong are already adjusting to their new reality. He says, yes, consumer confidence is low here, but it's improving.
I truly believe that this area is very solid. State Farm is going to stay with us. They're not going anywhere, and they're going to keep a certain amount of jobs here, at least for the time being. I'm really looking forward to finishing up the lots that we have, the land that we have to develop, and trying to figure out a balance between need and want.
For a more detailed look at housing sales data, check out our interactive graphic at our website, wglt.org. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find links to other stories in NPR's Shut Out of the Housing Market series right now at our website, wglt.org.
House is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard. Life used to be so hard.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport in Bloomington, offering Frontier flights nonstop to Denver International and Orlando International beginning September 24th. Cirrus says, don't travel before you travel, fly local. Details and schedules at CIRA.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas, still to come. Now that the smoke has cleared, 10 years after smoking bans took effect, Eric Stock takes stock in the effects on area businesses. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. Children with severe mental illnesses encounter many barriers to treatment, among them a shortage of psychiatric beds and insurance companies that deny coverage. But some parents discover a workaround. As Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman reports, they can trade custody for treatment.
Jim and Tony Hoy adopted their son Daniel as a toddler. He'd been severely neglected as a baby, starving and left for dead. As Daniel grew up in the North Chicago suburbs, Tony says he started to show signs of mental illness.
He held knives to people's throats. He tried putting his fingers and his tongue in the light sockets. He broke almost every door in the house. At the same time, he's a little boy. He didn't want to be that way. He didn't like being that way.
Daniel began therapy when he was 10, but the violence escalated. He was hospitalized almost a dozen times over 2 years. Doctors said he needed 24/7 residential care. It wasn't safe to bring him home. But Medicaid and private insurance denied coverage.
We were told that we had to pay out of pocket for it.
At least $100,000 a year, which they didn't have. Then, after the 11th hospitalization, the state of Illinois gave Tony an ultimatum.
And basically said, if you bring him home, we're going to charge you with child endangerment for failure to protect your other kids. And if you leave him at the hospital, we'll charge you with neglect.
And that option is a last-ditch workaround to get treatment. If you abandon your child at the hospital, just refuse to pick them up, the Child Welfare Agency steps in to take custody. It's called a lockout. Attorney Robert Farley Jr. says at that point, the state's obligated to pay for their care.
So you get residential services, but then you've given up custody of your child, which is, you know, barbaric. You have to give up your child to get something necessary.
So the Hoys left Daniel at the hospital.
What was the only thing we could do that kept everybody safe?
In 2010, 2 years after giving Daniel up, they sued the state. In a settlement the following year, they regained custody of their 15-year-old son and got the funding for his care. Around the same time, Farley decided to take on the lack of community mental health care on behalf of all Medicaid-eligible children in the state. He filed a class action lawsuit.
Well, there's really great federal laws, but someone's not out there enforcing them.
In the lawsuit, Farley claimed Illinois illegally withheld services from children with severe mental health disorders. A judge earlier this year ruled that the state must make reforms to comply with Medicaid law, which says medically necessary treatment must be covered. But that decision doesn't address another problem. There are six state agencies that interact with at-risk children, but they operate in silos. Democratic State Representative Sarah Feigenholt says this causes many kids to unnecessarily enter state custody through the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS.
It's almost like there's a vacuum and the kids are just being sucked into DCFS.
So she worked to get a bill passed in 2014. It orders those agencies to ensure families are never again torn apart like the Hoys. But data obtained by Side Effects shows today in Illinois, four families a month trade custody for mental health treatment. Feigenholt says the fact lockouts still happen shows a lack of commitment.
The question is, shouldn't government be stepping in and doing their job? And they're not. We just want them to do their job.
Well, if law could fix problems, we'd have a different world.
That's BJ Walker, head of DCFS. She says the reasons lockouts happen are complex. A spokesman for the agency said in an email that when they get blamed, it's like when a pitcher comes in at the end of a losing game to save the day and gets tagged with the loss. Heather O'Donnell is a lawyer with Thresholds, a mental health treatment provider in Chicago. She says lockouts can happen anywhere in the country, but the situation is particularly bad in Illinois.
What Illinois needs to put into place is a system that helps these families early on so that these kids never get hospitalized.
That's what the state is trying to fix now. A plan is due by October to meet the legal settlement. As for Daniel, he's 23. He's been out of residential treatment and stable for 5 years now. He has a 2-year-old daughter, works nights for a shipping company, and says he would not have gotten better without his parents.
Sometimes it's so hard to do it for yourself. It almost helps to know that, well, you know, I'm doing it for myself, but I'm also doing it for my family and for our relationship.
Daniel's mom, Tony, says he has exceeded every goal they set for him.
The kids do need services, but they also need the support of their families. And when they have both, a lot of kids can be a lot more successful.
Tony's thankful that despite losing Daniel while trying to help him, they ultimately made it through intact. Not every family does. And until that changes, Tony says she won't stop speaking out. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
You can hear more about this story by checking out a new podcast from Side Effects. It's called The Workaround, and it's about the great lengths people go to get health care.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time, supporting arts and culture, youth engagement, employment, career development, and more. More information about the impact you could have at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the way to get help for domestic violence. Mary Cullen has that story. It's been 10 years since Illinois went smoke-free in all public buildings, including bars and restaurants. GLT's Eric Stock looks back at the arguments that were made for and against the indoor smoking ban to see if new data and the passage of time have changed anyone's perspective on what was a hotly debated issue.
Bloomington Normal actually went smoke-free a year before the rest of the state. McLean County also passed its own smoking ban, but it exempted home-based businesses and six liquor establishments in unincorporated areas of the county. Those exemptions were later wiped out by the statewide ban. Talk of a ban sparked heated debate before its inception, particularly in bars and restaurants. Many establishment owners feared it would put a dent in their business at a time when profit margins are already thin.
You know, I saw a 15 to 20% decrease in business, and it's never gotten any better.
Tyler Holloway owns Fat Jack's Bar in downtown Bloomington and Maggie Miley's restaurant in Uptown Normal. He says it was especially tough on the bar because he sold cigars at Fat Jack's. That was about a $50,000 a year hit in sales.
I've tried to replace my cigar sales because we did quite a large amount of cigar sales, for that product out of here up until then, and then it went to zero, basically.
Holloway says many who liked to light up at his bar simply stopped coming.
There was a certain percentage of people that stopped coming out as much, put it that way. And, I know one couple that actually built a bar in their basement and just invited their smoking friends over to their house every Friday happy hour instead of coming here.
In other cases, Holloway says customers who are smoking outside are less likely buying alcohol. That also eats into sales. Fat Jack started serving food after the smoking ban was enacted, and many other bars recouped some of their lost revenue after the state legalized video gaming, though Holloway says adding video gambling machines hasn't completely erased that shortfall. Jen Lancaster owns The Bistro, a downtown Bloomington bar, and had co-owned Lancaster's, a fine dining restaurant, which closed in 2014.
We were told in endless meetings with different parties that the non-smoking community that was always complaining about, how it was so smoky in the bars, that they would come out and now support our businesses once the ban was in effect, and that did not happen.
Lancaster's biggest objection, she says bar and restaurant owners had no say in the matter. She says several had proposed a licensing fee they'd be willing to pay to have a smoking section in their establishments. That idea, she said, fell on deaf ears.
We're small independent bar owners, business owners, and I really thought that it should have been a decision that each of us made on our own.
While many business owners saw the indoor smoking ban as a government intrusion, health advocates praised the ban then and praised the ban now.
Our children are growing up expecting smoke-free indoor areas.
Kathy Dre, Vice President of Advocacy for the American Lung Association of Illinois, was one of the main advocates for the statewide ban when it passed in 2007. She says the health of smokers and non-smokers alike should trump the wishes of any business owner.
Restaurants and bars close all the time for many reasons. The people of Illinois have adjusted. They've come to expect indoor facilities to be smoke-free.
The American Lung Association polled Illinois residents before the smoking ban went into effect and on the 10-year anniversary of the ban. A decade ago, Illinoisans were evenly split on the issue. A decade later, nearly 9 in 10 polled said they support the ban.
I think that it says it all right there. You can't even get 9 out of 10 people to agree that the sky is blue, let alone support for a law like this.
The survey shows only 3 in 10 who smoke themselves oppose the ban. The Illinois Department of Public Health reports in the 10 years since the smoking ban passed, hospitalizations for asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and heart attacks, all conditions aggravated by secondhand smoke, have fallen 20%. In McLean County, smoking rates have dropped. Just prior to the ban, close to 21% of adults had smoked. The latest figures from 2013 showed it dropped to below 12%, nearly cut in half in 5 years. While there's no proof these bans or other restrictions have caused more people to kick the habit, Dre suggests it all plays a part.
All these things work hand in hand. The increase in the tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products also works to decrease those smoking prevalence rates.
Bar owners Tyler Holloway and Jan Lancaster, both non-smokers themselves, say the issue goes beyond health. Lancaster says the indoor ban forces smokers outside onto sidewalks that are already crowded on weekends when college students are in town. She says a combination of overly congested walkways with pedestrians, many of whom have been drinking, has often become a recipe for trouble.
You would have two people go out and smoke, and then all of a sudden all their friends had to go out and stand with them too. And that created some problems on the street with late night problems as far as vandalism, people making comments, etc.
And the bar owners say they don't have the time or the staffing to monitor foot traffic outside their businesses. This begs the question, who is enforcing the smoking ban? Police are typically on the front lines in the war on smoking, but Bloomington, Normal, and McLean County Sheriff's Police say they get few, if any, complaints. Sheriff John Sandage.
I think when the law was initially passed, we kind of took the stance that we weren't going to become the smoking police. However, if we do run across a violation, we will report it.
Sandage adds his officers aren't able to set aside time to specifically look for smoking scofflaws, but they do occasionally conduct sting operations looking for underage drinkers.
What we look for, of course, when we do not only bar checks, but our liquor inspections that we do through the Illinois Liquor Commission, we look for violations and have not found any.
Police believe the various public education campaigns about where you can and can't smoke have taken hold. Smoking ban enforcement responsibility actually lies with the McLean County Health Department through a federal grant provided by the Centers for Disease Control. Katie McHugh, Health Promotion Program Manager for the McLean County Health Department, says enforcement is typically based on complaints. Those can be filed on the Health Department's website. But she says the county sanitation crews will sometimes find suspected violators on their own.
We work with our environmental health, the sanitarians, to do that. So they're already going around doing routine inspections, and it's part of that checklist that they have to go through to check for ashtrays is usually the giveaway.
The county received just 8 smoking complaints in the last year. Fines start at $250, but McHugh says fines are rare.
They get a letter, and that usually takes care of it. People don't want to not be in compliance, but if need be, and I haven't had to deal with this yet, but if need be, we can go further on, and there are fines and citations that get written.
Second-time offenders are supposed to get fined $500, a third offense in the same year warrants a $2,500 fine. The county has levied 16 fines since the ban's inception in 2008, but none since 2015. Only 2 were ever fined the maximum, $2,500. McHugh says the health department puts more of its attention on prevention. It offers no smoking and no e-cigarette window signs for businesses. Though McHugh supports the ban herself, says she notices the difference whenever she leaves Illinois.
It certainly is a shock to me when I go to Indianapolis to go to concerts, or I go to Missouri and people can smoke in restaurants or things like that. I'm always thankful that in Illinois that's not something that we have to deal with. And I think most other people probably feel the same way.
The indoor smoking ban doesn't include e-cigarettes, which health advocates consider to be far more addictive and are heavily marketed to younger smokers. McHugh suspects vaping will soon be regulated the same way.
The FDA is starting to regulate them and things like that. It's just not included yet. There's all kinds of policies are starting to add language. If it already included language about tobacco, they're starting to add language about e-cigarettes too.
Bloomington banned the use of e-cigarettes in all city-owned buildings in 2016, but vaping is otherwise okay in other public buildings. While bar owners like Tyler Holloway say they don't like how the smoking ban has hurt their business, they do see some benefit.
I actually enjoy the fact that I don't have someone sitting next to me smoking at the bar, and that I don't go home at night after work smelling like an ashtray. So that is nice.
I'm Eric Stock.
Illinois is now one of 25 states that has a public smoking ban. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, GLT's Grow and the do's and don'ts of homemade pesticides and herbicides. 1 in every 3 women and 1 in every 7 men will be domestically abused by a partner at some point in their lives. That's according to Sana Ejibang, the director of Countering Domestic Violence at Mid-Central Community Action. GLT's Mary Cullen spoke with Ejibang about local resources for survivors of domestic violence.
It's estimated that Domestic Violence Act occurs every 15 seconds somewhere in the United States. That figure translates to over 2.5 million victims a year, and 85% of those victims are females. Here in Bloomington Normal, we have the Neville House, which serves local domestic violence victims. Ejibang says in fiscal year 2018, the house served nearly 750 local residents.
When we have an individual call or I'm speaking to an individual, they will be able to describe the behavior to you. They would not say, I'm a domestic violence victim. A lot of victims would not just admit that they're victims because domestic violence doesn't happen to strangers. These are people you have a domestic relation. This is someone you know, someone you care about, whether it's a partner, a significant other, a dating partner, a roommate, a family member. So those are the individuals that mean a lot to you. So it's always really difficult to fathom that someone that you care about, that you know so well, and they know you very well, would be the ones to abuse you.
The process for a domestic violence victim, from what I've heard, is that it starts with a hotline call. Can you take me through the process that a domestic violence victim goes through?
You're absolutely right. The process starts with a hotline call, which is a 24-hour hotline, is, I would say, the entry point to survivors seeking services. We provide a variety, a comprehensive number of services in the community, which is more of a wraparound service, because domestic violence doesn't just either happen once, or it's not just one presenting issue. There are usually other dynamics around it. So yes, individuals will call the hotline, which is also helps them with the confidentiality piece, because safety is very important to us, so they can call to get information. We have very trained advocates who will provide answers and any information, options, and walk them through what their needs are or their concerns are. So the first step is them calling the hotline. From there, the steps are different for everybody. Someone might call not really understanding what domestic violence is or what abuse is or what they're going through. So they might just call and we will go through information with them. Someone might call and safety is a great issue. So our option will be the Neville House or getting an order of protection. Some might call and we will do a safety assessment. Safety might not be an issue at that time. They would want to talk more with somebody for them to process what's going on and to find out the best option for them. So counseling will be one, support groups will be one, or if they're having questions about kids and what's affecting the kids, we have a youth advocate that does that. We provide those options to victims and they make decisions or pick the options that work for them.
You mentioned a safety assessment. Yeah. What exactly is that, and what do you determine after doing such an assessment?
We have an assessment that we call a lethality assessment, and it has different levels, and that's what we go through to determine the level of lethality. So the first level could be, has your partner, whether male or female, has he yelled at you before? Has he said any offensive words to you, whether in private or in public? Has he attacked your character or your behavior? Has he criticized you? That's the first level, which is the verbal piece. And then it goes with an escalation, which is a continuum, because that's what domestic violence is. It just doesn't happen with the physical. And we have verbal mental abuse, we have financial abuse, we have sexual abuse, and so we talk them through that lethality. The lethality, that's the level four, would be, does he have weapons? Has he threatened you with a weapon? Has he hit you? Has he strangled you? Has he threatened suicide? Has he threatened to kill you or kill himself? Those are the signs that we know would be a high lethality, where we would provide other options of, you know, the shelter, orders of protection, and other heightened options.
When you are speaking with maybe someone who doesn't know whether or not they're a victim of domestic violence, how exactly do you educate them on the topic?
Financial abuse is a big one that either the community or individuals don't even realize that it's abuse. So we're able to educate them about, you know, if he's calling your job every time to track you, or saying you're cheating on the job, or being physically abusive so that you are not... you're so bruised that you can't go to work, and doing things consistently for you to lose your job, that's financial abuse, or taking your money. So we're able to talk them through different things for them to be able to kind of notice that that's not consistent with a a healthy relationship. So what's a healthy relationship and what's not? And so we're able to provide all of that information, and at some point they get to recognize that that's not, you know, a healthy relationship.
You mentioned how domestic violence happens on somewhat of a spectrum.
Yes.
It can start with verbal abuse all the way up to physical abuse itself. So when it comes to someone who is coming in with something that's not threatening them in a physical sense, how do you go about counseling or approaching how to address that issue in that person's life?
And I mentioned earlier about being able to point out to them what a healthy relationship looks like. And I think that's where you start, because people grow up with, you know, with what they know and environments. You would have someone who has even experienced physical abuse, whether it's child abuse growing up and the yelling and all that, so normal growing up, that they would not see it as abuse. They would see it as very normal. And so it's important to provide them with the other perspective, which is the healthy perspective. And it's important for advocates and for us to be able to do that in such a way that you educate them. We also have materials. We have the power and control wheel. We have the equality wheel. So if we have someone in person, we are able to see that, those different materials, to see, oh, this is really interesting. Oh, using the children, that's actually abuse. Keeping the children from seeing a partner, that's power and control. So we're able to show that, and showing them what the healthy part looks like and how it should be and how they should feel as an individual and just being a healthy individual, and what doesn't feel right. They start pointing out the behavior that looks not so consistent with that. One of the things that we don't do is give advice or judge or point out, oh yeah, he should do this, you should do this, because the dynamic of domestic violence, it's power and control. They've been told what to do so many times, and so what we don't do is repeat the same thing that would look controlling without even realizing that that's what. So we're very conscious and strategic about the way that we provide information.
When it comes to domestic violence, there's more than one person in the equation. There's the victim, and then there's the abuser themselves. Is there any service provided to that abuser?
Absolutely. We have services for offenders in our community. I would say that with our county domestic violence program, we're a victim service program. And so we provide services to victims. But we're also aware that there needs to be services for the offender. We have the AVERT, Collaborative Solutions Program, that's an agency in town. We have the Twin City Behavioral Health. We have Chestnut that provides offender groups, and we work very closely with them. We understand that both programs or both agencies, we recognize that the basis of addressing the domestic violence issue is keeping victims safe and holding offenders accountable.
MCCA has the Neville House, which is the domestic violence shelter for the residents here in Bloomington Normal. Can you talk about the services that Neville House provides?
The way that I describe our services is immediate safety on one spectrum. In the middle, we have a lot of supportive services. And then on the other spectrum is long-term healing. So when you look at immediate safety, we have the Neville House, which is a 24-hour emergency shelter. The location is confidential. That is a safety piece where if a family or an individual is fleeing, they would be able to seek that safe haven to be able to kind of figure out the next steps. We also provide orders of protection, which is also an immediate or emergency service. We have court advocates at the courthouse that would help with the order of protection paperwork. I have to stress they're not attorneys, they're advocates, and so they're able to do that. They provide them with all the different options and kind of educate them about the process and the hearing and accompany them to the court. It's tough enough to go through domestic violence, and then it's tough enough to navigate the court system. So having someone who is experienced and educated about that system and having that support going to court. It's really helpful to victims. We also have, on that spectrum is the long-term healing. We have a therapist that would provide counseling and therapy for our victims. We have children's services. The kids who have gone through, whether they've experienced it or they've seen some type of abuse, it's very important to us because the kids who are able to have some type of intervention or some services at an early age, they will grow up to be very productive adults, and 70% of those kids will be fine when they grow up if there's that type of intervention. Without that intervention, you're looking at kids growing up who are potential offenders and potential victims. And we've seen that. We've seen the cycle, the intergenerational cycle. So we take that very seriously, and we have a youth services advocate that will work with the parents and the kids. And as I said earlier, a victim will come in and would need just one of those services and be okay. A victim will come in and would need all of those services. And we serve both adults and children, and we serve men also. And that's a question that a lot of people ask about. We do a lot of training and presentations in the community because we believe that educating the community about domestic violence is also really important. When I go out and talk about domestic violence, and the first question I hear is, well, why didn't she leave? That tells me there's still that stigma about victim blaming, just like in sexual assault, where they would say, what was she wearing? So there's still that stigma about they must have done something wrong to deserve the abuse. And you have to keep talking about dynamics and the reason why individuals stay, because there are so many reasons why people stay in an abusive relationship. And when they're ready and with that support, they would leave. And so we think one of our huge focus with our program is to provide that public awareness and education so that individuals know that there are resources available if they should need help or if they know someone who's gone through that. They also need to know in the community.
That was Mary Cullen speaking with Mid-Central Community Action's Director of the Program Countering Domestic Violence, Sena Ajabeng. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The word homemade usually denotes wholesome or delicious, like homemade pie. But when it comes to homemade herbicides, pesticides, or other remedies, just as much caution is needed as with the commercially produced chemicals. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy shares his opinion about homemade solutions with GLT's Mike McCurdy.
The instinct for most people is a trip to the big box store or gardening center to fix a problem in the vegetable garden or landscaping, see a weed, buy weed killer. But there are also home remedies and mixtures for some problems. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences, and he's the curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with pests. What are some easy homemade remedies, homemade ways to deal with insects, for instance?
When it comes to the unwanted pests, the safest bet are the soapy water mixes that utilize liquid dish soap. And I'm always cautious about the ones that that add vinegar. We can talk about vinegar. It can be just as harmful as pouring synthetics out on the ground. But the soapy water mixes are effective. They typically require repeated use. And the soapy water is helpful to the plant, too. But the way it helps with the insects is it soapy water covers the body of whatever insect is there. Insects breathe through little holes in their bodies, and that is not good for the insect. But it's soapy water, so it's going to dry up, and it might require multiple applications. And soapy water is good because there's a little bit of nitrogen in there, and there's a lot of water mixed in with that home remedy typically, and it's why the grass is greener where you park your car when you wash it in the yard.
So you actually have to apply it to the insect. Something with 7, for instance, if you apply it to the plant and the insect eats the plant, it ingests the pesticide.
I'm not aware of any home remedy that is a systemic that other than BT and milky spore, which we've talked about many times on Grow.
And that takes some time to actually develop.
That takes some years to build up in the soil.
So what's the mixture? Is it 2-to-1 water soap?
I am reluctant to endorse them, Mike, because I think that the same caution goes with the home remedies, it goes with the synthetic chemical, because you're still dumping stuff out on the ground. You just are.
No, we're talking about the insects, though. That's effective, right?
Yeah. But the thing is, you got to spray the insect itself and not the plant, you know, but some of it's going to get on the plant no matter what. So if you're spraying for scale insects, they're very difficult to track down and corner, and they'll just move into the undersides of the plant. So then you have to make sure when you spray that you have a sprayer that allows you to spray the inside and under leaf areas of your plants.
So too much soap, though, could damage the plant, could damage the soil?
Yeah, there's a potential there. There's a potential there. Just soapy water is probably not going to be a problem. But when you start adding things like soap, vinegar, or salt, vinegar, baking soda, which are oftentimes ingredients in other gardening concoctions, I think that's where you start to get into possible trouble.
Sure. I'm going to go there in a minute. Let's talk about deer and rabbits. What about keeping those rodents and mammals away from your garden?
That is one that I think is worth hanging on to, because the pepper pulp or cayenne pepper mixed with water, and sometimes soap is used in that arrangement also, because then it's a suspension agent, but its persistence is very short. So during dry, windy weather, it just dries up.
And blows away.
And it breaks down and it goes away. And when it rains, it's gone. So if you start to get into the time of the year where there's dew on the plants in the morning, or the weather causes that phenomenon.
Even dew will wash it away.
That's going to break it down just as fast. But the thing is, you can make that out of stuff that you grow on your own property and everything. And the persistency is not much different than the store-bought product. And I've used that before in my professional experience, and it's different than the homemade stuff because you can't wash it off your hand.
Hmm. Partially effective, but it's short term.
Yeah, and then like in the eradication of unwanted plants and killing of pests, this is kind of the same arrangement.
Well, let's talk about pesky plants. Weeds encroaching around a vegetable garden or in the garden. I've used a salt, vinegar, dish soap combo with varying degrees of success. What's your concern about that mixture?
It's not a concern. It's just a point of view that, you know, hey, we're still dumping stuff, the vinegar and the salt and stuff like that. It can cause a change in the chemistry of your soil. It can create binding, which is a scenario that reduces plants' ability to get available nutrients. It burns the plant off, and that's the desired outcome. But it usually just affects the above-ground part. So for certain weed pests that you're handling, they're going to come back like with a vengeance, you know, like their brothers and baseball bats. After you burn them off, they're coming right back. And so then you get into the combination, the IPM, integrated pest management combination. You need a little bit of spray and then a little bit of mechanical eradication. So you might want to try and get some of those roots out of there at that end stage, when the weed has finally been burnt to death by whatever your mixture is. That's a good time to grab a hold of it with a glove and get it out of there.
So that was my experience. It on a sunny day, it worked on some of the plants within an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But a week later, that plant was back. I didn't see it growing back with a vengeance, but it was back. So I repeated that. And I was concerned about continuing to repeat that application, concerned about the amount of salt or vinegar. Now, I was using a spray bottle. It wasn't a lot, just enough to coat the leaf. I wasn't pouring it on, for instance, but it did concern me.
Yeah, and you know, and to be accurate, not all weeds will come back like that. Some in particular that I've seen come back very aggressively is just your water grass, your annual bluegrass, you know, Poa annua, not the Kentucky bluegrass perennial kind, and the nettle that grows flat and spreads out on the ground. It's a hot season weed. They're the ones that seem to take it and come back for more. Yeah. But if it gives you the outcome you're looking for, hopefully you won't have to keep applying it. I think that the environmental mission that I'm on is to remind everyone that the use of these requires the same discretion as a synthetic chemical.
Salt is a chemical.
Yeah, right.
Vinegar is high in acid.
And if it all worked as well as we want it to work, because I want it to work well. Because when you buy the synthetics and take them home, it takes a long time to use them up if you're using them correctly. You might as well help your neighbors out. You know, let them know you bought a bottle of Roundup. It'll be around when the kids graduate from college.
That's why I buy the smallest container possible.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't have a lot of it left over and have it expire on me. And then, you know, what do I do with it? I have to wait till the next household hazardous waste collection. So you can use salt to kill a stump to make sure it doesn't come back?
I've seen this done, and I've done it myself, and it's a farmer's almanac technique. That's where a lot of these home remedies lie, along with gardening magazines and places like that. But the general idea is to bore holes in the stump near the outer edge of the stump where the tree was alive. Because, you know, the outer skin under the bark, that's where the nutrients travel. Well, you could drill yourself some holes in there, you know, at least eight. So that's the four points of the compass and then the points in between. And they could be a small hole like the size of a pencil. And you can fill them with table salt or rock salt. And salt is poisonous to plants. The salt interrupts any potential for that plant to try and kind of regrow from its roots. You know, and if you've cut down a silver maple or a mulberry tree or buckthorn, you know that they can come back very quick. You know, so if it was something small, you know, like the size of a baseball bat, you might only need one or two holes and fill those up with salt and then come back a year later.
Instead of pest prevention or weed killer, what about homemade mixtures that are beneficial to apply to a plant? Maybe fertilizing it or feeding it somehow?
Yes. I've heard of lots of composters and gardeners that make various kinds of tea. And it's a liquid solution that is basically water that is passed through organic matter and poured like a slurry or a drench on the ground. And it's like a liquid homemade liquid fertilizer.
Okay, so if you have any questions about homemade solutions to your gardening problems or about anything in your yard or garden, submit them at WGLT.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about transplanting large plants. Tree-sized, Murph?
Not too big, but definitely some trees.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
Subscribe to the Grow Podcast and find past episodes at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker.